What are you doing, David? Ralph asked tightly. The boy held up the wallet. Taking this back. He hesitated, then added, I'm supposed to find him. I'll come back if I can, with Johnny if I can. David went to his father and began to hug him. As Ralph's arms went around the boy in response, David felt that enormous force grab at him again. He jerked convulsively in his father's arms, gasping, then took a blind step backward. David! Ralph cried. David, what? And it was over, as quickly as that. The force left. What is it? Ralph asked unsteadily. Christ almighty, what now? He saw he had dropped the wallet and bent to pick it up. Wouldn't do to leave it here. Gosh, no. He thought of putting it into his own back pocket, then thought of how it had fallen out of Johnny's and dumped it down the front of his shirt instead. You have to go to the pit, he told his father. Daddy, you and Steve and Cynthia have to go to the China pit right now. Mary needs help. Tuck is chasing her. You have to go right now. David jumped from the Ryder truck's tailgate into the street. David, Cynthia cried. Splitting up like this? Are you sure it's right? No, he shouted back. He felt desperate, confused, and more than a little stunned. I know how wrong it feels. It feels wrong to me, too, but there's nothing else. I swear to you, there's just nothing else. And before anyone could ask another question, David Carver turned on his heels and went pelting off into the dark. With one hand, he pumped the air. The other he held against the front of his shirt, cupping John Edward Marinville's genuine alligator wallet, $350, Barney's, of New York. The thought which flashed across Johnny's mind as the wolf charged him was the kid saying that the creature running this show wanted them to leave town, would be happy to let them go. Maybe it was a little glitch in the kid's second sight, or maybe Tuck had just seen a chance to pick one of them off and was taking it. He brandished the hammer at the oncoming wolf and yelled, "Get out of here!" in a shrill voice he barely recognized as his own. The wolf broke left and turned in a tight circle, growling as it went, hindquarters low to the ground, tail tucked. "Get out!" Johnny yelled at it in his shrill, wavering voice. "Get out, right now!" Instead of getting out, the wolf's hindquarters screwed down toward the floor. For a moment, Johnny thought it was going to take a crap. Then a split second before it happened, he realized the wolf was preparing not to crap, but to leap at him. "Oh, God, no, please!" he screamed and turned to run back toward the ATV and the bodies hanging stiffly on their hooks. In his head, he did this. His body moved in the opposite direction, forward, as if directed by hands he could not see. His terror fell away. His first powerful instinct to turn and run also fell away. He took a step forward instead. Pushing off from the table with his free hand, he cocked the hammer back to beyond his right shoulder and hurled it just as the wolf launched itself at him. He expected the hammer to spin and was sure it would sail over the animal's head. He had pitched at Lincoln Park High School about 1,000 years ago and still knew the feeling of one that was going to be wild high. But it didn't. It didn't turn over and it didn't go high. What it did was strike the wolf dead center between the eyes. There was a sound like a brick dropped on an oak plank. The green glare whiffed out of the wolf's eyes. They turned into old marbles, even as the blood began to pour out of the animal's center-split skull. Then it hit him in the chest, driving him back against the table, setting off a brilliant burst of pain in the small of his back. Then it dropped on his feet, like something loose and heavy wrapped in a ratty old steamer blanket. "Is it time to reconsider David Carver's God?" Terry asked quietly. Stereo Terry now. She had a place in his head, and she also had a place on the wall under You Must Wear a Hard Hat. "Not bad, Ace," said a voice from the doorway. Johnny wheeled around. The boy was standing there, David, looking at the wolf. Then he raised his unsmiling face to Johnny. "Lucky shot," Johnny said. "Think that was it?" "If you came here to try and persuade me to stay, you're shit out of luck," Johnny said. He bent over the coupling between the ore car and the ATV and took a swing at the cotter pin. He missed it completely and smashed his hand painfully against an angle of metal. He cried out and stuck his scraped knuckles into his mouth. He tightened his grip on the hammer's rubber sleeve and bent over the coupling again. This time he hit it pretty well, not dead center, but close enough to pop the cotter pin free and send it rolling across the floor. It stopped beneath the dangling feet of the woman who looked like Terry. "If you came to talk theology, you're similarly out of luck," Johnny said. "If, however, you'd like to accompany me west to Austin..." He broke off. The boy now had something in his hand, was holding it out to him. "Your wallet," David said, his eyes on him so steady. "It fell out of your pocket in the truck. I brought it to you. It's got all your ID in it, in case you forget who you are." "Very funny." "I wasn't joking. There's a picture in it. You and two other guys standing in front of a place called the Viet Cong Lookout. A bar, I think." "Yeah, a bar," Johnny agreed. He flexed his hand uneasily on the shaft of the hammer, barely feeling the sting run across his scraped knuckles. "The tall guy in that picture's David Halberstam, very famous writer." "I was more interested in the ordinary-sized guy in the middle," David said. And all at once, a part of Johnny, a deep, deep part, knew what the child was driving at, what the child was going to say, and that part moaned in protest. "The guy in the gray shirt and the Yankees hat. The guy that showed me the China pit from my Viet Cong lookout. That guy was you." "What crap," Johnny said. "The same kind of crazed crap you've been spouting ever since." Softly, perfectly on key, and still holding the wallet out to him on one hand, David Carver sang, "Well, I feel so good, everybody's getting high." It was like being slugged square in the middle of his chest. "Stop it," he whispered. "Better take it easy, 'cause the place is on fire." "Stop it," Johnny screamed. He could feel stuff starting to move inside him. Terrible stuff, sliding, like an avalanche beginning under a surface that only looks solid. "Spencer Davis Group," David said. "Steve Winwood on vocals. Very cool. That's the song that was playing when you died, wasn't it, Johnny?" Images began to slide downhill through his mind while Steve Winwood sang, "Wait a minute, baby, let it happen to you." ARVN soldiers, many no bigger than American sixth graders, pulling dead buttocks apart, looking for hidden treasure, a nasty scavenger hunt in a nasty war. Kanta in Kantok. Coming back to Terry with a dose in his crotch and a monkey on his back, wanting to score so bad he was half out of his mind, slapping her in an airport concourse when she said something smart about the war. His war, she'd called it, as if he had invented the fucking thing. Slapping her so hard that her mouth and nose bled. And although the marriage had limped along for another year or so, it had really ended right there in Concourse B of the United Terminal at LaGuardia, with the sound of that slap. In Trajan, kicking him as he lay writhing on Highway 50, not kicking a literary lion or the National Book Award winner or the only white male writer in America who mattered, but just some pot-bellied geezer in an overpriced motorcycle jacket, one who owed God a death like anyone else. "At first I didn't understand how it could have been you," David said, as if he hadn't heard. "It was the land of the dead. You even said so, Johnny. But you were alive. That's what I thought, at least. You died, when? 1966? 1968? I guess it doesn't matter. When a person stops changing, stops feeling, they die. The times you tried to kill yourself since, you were just playing catch-up, weren't you?" And the child smiled at him with a sympathy that was unspeakable in its innocence and kindness and lack of judgment. "Johnny," David Carver said, "God can raise the dead." "Fuck you, little hero. I'm going to Austin. You hear me? Fucking Austin." "Talk will be there ahead of you," David said. He was still holding out the wallet, the one with the picture of Johnny and David Halberstam and Duffy Panette, standing outside that sleazy little bar. In his head, Johnny could taste Kieran beer and hear the Spencer Davis Group, the drive of the drums, the organ like a dagger, and how hot it had been, how green and how hot, the sun like thunder, the earth smelling like pussy every time it rained. And that song had seemed to come from everywhere, every club, every radio, every shithole juke. In a way, that song was Vietnam. "Wait a minute, baby, let it happen to you." "That Austin," he whispered in a feeble, failing voice. I won't," he tried to scream again. But this time no voice came out, and when he struck at the ore cart again, the hammer dropped free of his fingers. His thighs turned watery, and his knees began to unhinge. He slipped onto them with a choked and drowning cry. He was dividing himself in two. There was John Edward Marinville, who didn't believe in God and didn't want God to believe in him. That creature wanted to go, and understood that Austin would only be the first stop. And there was Johnny, who had to stay. Moore, who wanted to fight, who had progressed far enough into this mad supernaturalism to want to die in David's God, to burn his brain in it, and go out like a moth in the chimney of a kerosene lamp. Johnny felt himself leave his own body, felt himself grasped by hands that were not his own, and turned out like change from a pocket. He stood ghost-like beside the kneeling man, and saw the kneeling man holding his hands out. "I'll take it," the kneeling man said. He was weeping. "I'll take my wallet. What the fuck? Give it back." He saw the boy come to the kneeling man and kneel beside him. He saw the kneeling man take the wallet and then put it in the front pocket of the jeans beneath the chaps so he could press his hands together, finger to finger, as David had done. "What do I say?" the kneeling man asked, weeping. "Oh, David, how do I start? What do I say?" "What's in your heart?" the kneeling boy said. And that was when the ghost gave up and rejoined the man. Clarity streaked into the world, lighting it up, lighting him up like napalm. And he heard Steve Winwood singing, "Now I'm gonna relax, baby, everybody should. Help me, God," Johnny said, raising his hands to a place where they were even with his eyes and he could see them well. "Oh, God, please help me. Help me do what I was sent here to do. Help me to be whole. Help me to live. God, help me to live again." "Catch you, bitch," it thought triumphantly. At first, chances of that had seemed unlikely. Once she started down the other side, Mary had been able to extend her lead in a hurry, because she could breathe deeply. She could cope with her body's oxygen debt. Ellen Carver's body, on the other hand, was rapidly losing the ability to do either. The vaginal bleeding had become a flood, and as it came over the rim of the pit, something had ruptured in Ellen's left lung as well. Now, with every exhale, it was shooting out liquid jets of blood and tissue from both Ellen's mouth and nose. Then, a miracle. Running too fast for the grade and trying to look back over her shoulder at the same time, the bitch's feet tangled together and she took a spectacular tumble, hitting the gravel surface of the road in a kind of swan dive and plowing downhill for almost 10 feet before she came to a stop, leaving a dark drag mark behind her. She lay face down with her arms extended, trembling all over. In the starlight, her splayed hands looked like pale creatures fished out of a tide pool. "Now, now, Tak Awan!" Tak ran at the woman lying in the road, screaming in soundless, hungry triumph as it closed the gap. Mary could hear something coming, something that was yelling nonsense words in a thick, gargly voice. But it all seemed unimportant, like things heard in a dream. And surely this had to be a dream, didn't it? "Get up, Mary. You have to get up." "I can't. I'm scraped all over, and it's too late anyway," she moaned to the voice. But even as she was moaning, she was struggling with her knee, trying to cock it under her. The Ellen thing was in full charge now. It seemed to be exploding out of its clothes as it came, and it was screaming, a drawn-out howl of rage and hunger packed in blood. Mary got on her feet, screaming herself now as the thing swooped down, reaching out, grasping for her with its fingers. She threw herself into a full downhill sprint, eyes bulging, mouth sprung open in a full-jawed but silent scream. "Bitch!" An inhuman guttural growl and a hand closed on her hair. It might have held if the hair had been dry, but it was slick, almost slimy with sweat. For a moment she felt the thing's fingers on the back of her neck, and then they were gone. She ran down the slope in lengthening leaps, her fear now mingling with a kind of crazy exhilaration. There was a thud from behind her. She risked a look back and saw that the Ellen thing had gone down. Its hands opened and closed on thin air, as if still searching for the woman who had barely managed to elude it. Mary turned and focused on the blinker light. It was closer now. And there were other lights as well, she was sure of it. Headlights, and coming this way. She focused on them, ran toward them. She never even registered the large shape which passed silently above her. All over. It had come so close, had actually touched the bitch's hair, but at the last second, Mary had eluded it. It rolled over onto Ellen's back, staring up at the star-filled sky, moaning with pain and hate to have come so close. That was when it saw the dark shape up there, blotting out the stars in a kind of gliding crucifix, and felt a sudden fresh burst of hope. It rose in this fading body like a flame in a dark room. "Beam," it whispered in its dying, blood-thick voice. "Can the light beam in and talk? Talk." It held up Ellen's dying arms, and the golden eagle fluttered down into them, staring into its dying face with rapt eyes.
The ATV was riding over ridges of sand in a series of tooth-rattling jounces. Up ahead, Johnny could see the edge of town. He wanted to go faster, but anything beyond second gear seemed imprudent, given the short reach of the headlights. It might be true that they were in God's hands, but God reputedly helped those who helped themselves. Maybe that was why he had kept the hammer, tucking it into his belt before leaving Hernando's hideaway.
"I have a friend. Brian Ross, his name is. He's my best friend. Once we made a Parthenon entirely out of bottle caps."
"Did you?"
"Uh-huh. Brian's dad helped us a little, but mostly we did it ourselves. We'd stay up Saturday nights and watch old horror movies. The black and white ones? Frankenstein was good, but we liked The Mummy even better. We were always going to each other, 'Oh, shit, the mummy's after us. We better walk a little faster.' Goofy stuff like that. But fun, you know?"
Johnny smiled and nodded.
"Anyway, Brian was in an accident. A drunk hit him while he was riding to school. I mean, 8:15 in the morning and this guy's drunk on his ass. Do you believe that?"
"Sure," Johnny said. "You bet." David gave him a considering look, nodded, then went on.
"Brian hit his head. Bad. Fractured his skull and hurt his brain. He was in a coma and he wasn't supposed to live, but..."
"Let me guess the rest. You prayed to God that your friend would be all right, and 2 days later, bingo, that boy be walking and talking, praise Jesus, my Lord and Savior."
"You don't believe it?"
Johnny laughed. "Actually, I do. After what's happened to me since this afternoon, that seems perfectly sane and reasonable."
"I went to a place that was special to me and Brian to pray. A platform we built in a tree. We called it the Viet Cong Lookout."
Johnny looked at him gravely. "You're not kidding about that?" David shook his head.
"I can't remember which one of us named it that now, but that's what we called it. That was our place. That's where I went, and what I said was..."
He closed his eyes, thinking.
"What I said was, 'God make him better. If you do, I'll do something for you. I promise.'"
David opened his eyes again.
"He got better almost right away."
"And now it's payback time. That's the bad part, right?" David turned toward Johnny, his face grave.
"The bad thing isn't that God would put me in a position where I'd owe him a favor, but that he'd hurt Brian to do it."
"God is cruel." David nodded, and Johnny saw the boy was on the verge of tears.
"He sure is. Better than talk, maybe, but pretty mean just the same."
"But God's cruelty is refining.
That's the rumor anyway, yeah?
Well, maybe.
Maybe it wasn't all about you anyway. Maybe someday your pal is going to cure AIDS or cancer. Maybe he'll hit in 60 straight games.
Maybe.
David, this thing that's out there. Talk. What is it? Do you have any idea? An Indian spirit?
I don't think so. I think it's more like a disease than a spirit or even a demon. Talk is the ancient one. The unformed heart.
The boy was shivering a little, and his face looked even paler. Maybe that was just the starlight, but Johnny didn't like it. We don't need to talk about it anymore if you don't want to, all right?
David nodded, then pointed up ahead.
Look, there's the Ryder van. It stopped. They must have found Mary. Isn't that great?
It sure is, Johnny said. The truck's headlights were half a mile or so further on, shining out in a fan toward the base of the embankment. He turned to David, meaning to ask if David knew where there might be a few more sardines hiding, when his head suddenly turned into a soundless, brilliant airburst. He jerked backward in the driver's seat, shoulders twisting. A strangled cry escaped him. The ATV swerved toward the left side of the road. David leaned over, grabbed the wheel, and corrected their course just before the vehicle could nose over the edge and tumble into the desert. By then, Johnny's eyes were open again. He braked instinctively, throwing the boy forward. Then they were stopped, the ATV idling in the middle of the road, not 200 feet from the Ryder van's taillights.
Holy shit, David breathed. For a second or two there...
Johnny looked at him, dazed and amazed, as if seeing him for the first time in his life. Then his eyes cleared and he laughed shakily. Holy shit is right, he said. Thanks, David.
Was it a God bomb?
What?
A big one. Like Saul on the road to Damascus, when the cataracts or whatever they were fell out of his eyes and he could see again. You just had one, didn't you?
All at once he didn't want to look at David, was afraid of what David might see in his eyes. He looked at the rider's taillights instead. Fix your eyes, Johnny, Terry said. Fix your eyes so you can look at him without a single blink. You know how to do that, don't you? Yes, he certainly did. He remembered something an old literature prof of his had said. Lying is fiction, this crusty old reptile had proclaimed with a dry and cynical grin. Fiction is art, and therefore all art is a lie. He turned to David and met David's concerned gaze with a rueful little smile. No God bombs, David. Sorry to disappoint you.
Then what just happened?
I had a seizure. Everything just came down on me at once, and I had a seizure. As a young man, I used to have one every 3 or 4 months. Petit mal. Took medication, and they went away. When I started drinking heavily around the age of 40, they came back. The seizures are the main reason I keep trying to go on the wagon. He got rolling again. David asked no more questions, but he kept glancing over at him. Johnny discovered he could actually feel that glance, like soft, skilled fingers patting their way along the top of a window, feeling for the catch that would unlock it. Steve had brought a blanket along to cover the boss's scoot with in the event that he did end up having to transport the Harley to the West Coast in the back of the truck. When Johnny and David pulled up in the ATV, Mary Jackson had this blanket wrapped around her shoulders like a tartan shawl. She was shivering in spite of the blanket and felt like a refugee in a TV news clip. She watched Ralph give his son a fierce, one-armed hug, the Ruger 44 in his other hand, actually lifting him up off his feet and then setting him down again. Steve went over to David in Marinville.
David? All right?
Yes, David said. So's Johnny.
Steve looked at the man he had been hired to shepherd, his face noncommittal.
That so?
I think so, Marinville said. He glanced at David.
You tell him, Cabbage. You got the head on you.
David smiled wanly at that.
He had a change of heart, and if it was my mother you were looking for, the thing that was inside my mother, you can stop. She's dead. We'll find her body about halfway up the embankment.
Then, in a voice which struggled to be matter-of-fact and failed, he added,
I don't want to look at her. And when you move her out of the way, I mean. Dad, I don't think you should either.
Mary walked over to them, rubbing the backs of her thighs where the ache was the worst.
The Ellen body is finished,
and it couldn't quite catch me. So it's stuck in its hole again, isn't it?
Yes.
Mary didn't like the doubtful sound of David's voice. There was more guessing than knowing in it. David, she asked, we're not done, even if it is stuck in there, are we? We're supposed to close the drift.
First the Antak, David said, nodding. Then the drift, yeah. Seal it in, like it was before.
The boy walked back to the truck with Mary, slipping his arm around her waist and leaning his head against her arm as if she was his mother. Mary guessed she could be that for a while, if he needed her to be. When the truck stopped halfway up the grade, Mary felt David's grip on her waist tighten and put an arm around his shoulders. They had come to the place where his mother, her shell anyway, had finished up. Mary put a hand on the side of his head and urged him wordlessly with it. He came willingly enough, putting his face against her breast, and then she felt the first of his tears wetting her shirt. Across from her, David's father was sitting with his knees pulled up to his chest and his hands over his face. Doors slammed. Feet crunched on the gravel. Then faintly, Cynthia Smith's voice, full of horror.
Oh, jeez, look at her.
Be quiet, stupid. They'll hear you.
Oh, shit, sorry.
From outside, she could now hear shuffling steps as Steve and Cynthia carried Ellen out of the road. There was a pause, a little grunt of effort from the girl, and then the footsteps came back to the truck. They got back in. The door slammed, the engine revved, and they started off again. David kept his face pressed against her a moment or two longer, then raised his head.
Thanks.
Any time, she said. She kissed his cheek. Really. 5 minutes later, the truck stopped and the cab doors opened. David pointed to the concrete cube near the field office.
First we have to get inside there.
They walked over to the powder magazine. Ralph yanked at the padlock on the door as if to get the feel of it, then racked the Ruger. The rest of you stand back, he said. This always works great in the movies, but in real life, who knows? There was a long moment of silence and then a high whip-crack rifle report that should have echoed and didn't. It was just there and then gone, absorbed by the walls and benches and valleys of the open pit. In its aftermath, she heard one startled bird cry, "Quack!" and then nothing more. When Ralph yanked, the lock's arm popped free of its ruined innards. Ralph pulled it off the hasp and threw it aside. Steve pulled the door open and peered in. Man, darker than a carload of assholes. There's a flashlight in the truck behind the seat. Why don't you go get it? Johnny said. But for a moment or two, Steve didn't move. He was looking at Johnny with a strange expression, one Mary couldn't quite read on his face. Johnny saw it too. What? Something wrong? Nope, Steve said. Nothing wrong, boss. Then step on it. Steve Ames marked the exact moment when control over their little expeditionary force passed from David to Johnny. The moment when the boss became the boss again. Why don't you go get it? A nominal question. Just 6 words. And everything had changed. The flashlight, a long-barreled 6-battery job, was under a crushed litter of maps, along with the first aid kit and a cardboard box with a few road flares in it. He tried the light, saw that it worked, and jogged back to the others. Steve stepped into the powder magazine and shone his light around. The rear wall was studded with spikes driven into the cinder block. Hung on these were coils of wire and fat white cord. Debt cord, Steve assumed. Against the right and left walls, facing each other like bookends with no books between them, were two heavy wooden chests. The one marked dynamite and blasting caps was open, the lid up like the lid of a child's toy box. The other, marked simply Blasting Agent, in black letters, against an orange background, was padlocked shut. Steve walked toward the dynamite cabinet. No dino in there, Johnny said, sounding weirdly serene. He was right about the dynamite, but the cabinet was far from empty. The body of a man, in jeans and a Georgetown Hoyas t-shirt, was crammed into it. He had been shot in the head. His glazed eyes stared up at Steve from below what might once have been blonde hair. Steeling himself against the smell, Steve leaned over and worked at the key ring hanging on the man's belt. Steve gave the keys to Ralph. One of these, maybe? It didn't take long. The third key Ralph tried slid into the padlock on the chest marked Blasting Agent. A moment later, the five of them were looking inside at what looked like long cheesecloth bags. Littered among them were a few escapees, round white pellets that looked to Steve like whitewashed birdshot. The bags had drawstring tops. He lifted one out. Written on the side in black were the letters ANFO. Below them in red, CAUTION, FLAMMABLE, EXPLOSIVE.
Okay, Steve said. But how are we going to set it off with no booster?
Johnny looked at Steve, then at the others.
I wonder if the rest of you would step outside with David for a moment. I'd like to speak to Steve alone. It's a little unfinished business, that's all. An apology.
Mary said, I hardly think this is the time. The boss had been signaling him, signaling urgently with his eyes.
It's okay, Steve said. It'll be quick. And don't go empty-handed, Johnny said. Each of you take a bag of this instant 4th of July.
I want to know what's going on here, Cynthia said. She sounded worried.
Nothing, Johnny told her, his voice soothing. Really.
The fuck there ain't,
Cynthia said morosely. But she went with the others, each of them carrying a bag of ANFO. David stood a moment longer, lost in thought. Abruptly he looked up at Johnny and said,
Turn out your pockets, all of them.
What? Steve began. Johnny shushed him, smiling oddly. It was the smile of someone who has bitten into something which tastes both bitter and compelling. David knows what he's doing. He unbuckled the chaps, turned out the pockets of his jeans underneath, handing Steve his goods, the famous wallet, his keys, the hammer which had been stuck in his belt, to hold as he did. Then he unbuckled his pants and pushed them down. He did a 360, arms slightly raised, giving David all the angles and bruises, then pulled up his jeans again. The chaps followed. Satisfied?
Go on and have your talk, David said. But hurry it up.
And he was gone, leaving Steve and Johnny alone.
He wanted to make sure you didn't have a few of those cantas on you, didn't he? Like Audrey.
Johnny nodded.
He's a wise child.
I guess he is.
Steve shuffled his feet, looked at them, then back up at the boss.
Look, you don't need to apologize for buzzing off. Why don't we just...
I owe a lot of apologies, Johnny said. But you're really the least of my worries in that respect, Steve, especially now. Just shut up and listen, all right?
All right?
And this really does have to be speedy. David already suspects I'm up to something. That's why he wanted me to turn out my pockets. There'll come a moment, very soon now, when you're going to have to grab David. When you do, make sure you get a good grip, because he's going to fight like hell, and make sure you don't let go.
Why?
Steve, you have to trust me.
Why should I?
Because I had a moment of revelation on the way up here. Except that's way too stiff. I like David's phrase better. He asked me if I got hit by a god bomb. I told him no, but that was a lie.
What's going to happen? Do you even know?
No, not completely.
I can't do what you want, Steve said flatly. I don't trust you enough to do what you want.
Johnny came a step closer. David thinks God means him to die in order to close Tuckup in his bolt hole again. The final sacrifice, so to speak. But David's wrong. Johnny's voice cracked on the last word, and Steve was astonished to see that the boss was almost crying. It's not going to be that easy for him.
What?
Johnny grabbed his arm, his grip so tight it was painful. Shut up, Steve. Just grab him when the time comes. It's up to you. Come on now. He bent into the chest, grabbed a bag of ANFO by its drawstring, and tossed it to Steve. He got another for himself. They walked out into what was left of the night and joined the others. At the bottom of the slope, 20 yards below the square yawn that was China Shaft, Johnny stopped them and told them to tie the drawstrings of the bags together in pairs. He slipped one of these pairs around his own neck, the sacks hanging down on either side of his chest like the counterweights of a cuckoo clock. Steve took another pair, and Johnny made no objection when David took the last set from his father and slipped the joined drawstrings around his own neck.
What's going to happen?
Mary asked. I mean, what's the plan?
We do what God tells us, David said. That's the plan. Come on.
It was David who led, going up the slope side saddle to keep from falling. There was no wide gravel road here, not even a path, and the ground was evil. If it had been 40 yards uphill instead of 20, Johnny wasn't sure he could have made it. As it was, the pounding of his heart had become so rapid it seemed like one steady thrum in his chest by the time David reached the ragged shaft opening. He made himself move a little faster, suddenly afraid that David might simply turn and go into the shaft before he could get there. But David waited, and soon they were all clustered on the slope in front of the opening. A dank smell issued from it, chilly and charred at the same time.
"We ought to pray,"
David said, sounding timid. He held his hands out to either side of him. His father took one of his hands. Steve put down the .30-06 and took the other. Mary took Ralph's. Cynthia took Steve's. Johnny stepped between the two women, and the circle was complete. They stood in the darkness of China Pit, smelling the dank, exhaled breath of the earth, looking at David Carver, who had brought them here.
"Whose father?"
David asked them.
"Our father," Johnny said, stepping easily onto the road of the old prayer as if he had never been away. "Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come."
The others joined in, Cynthia, the minister's daughter, first, Mary last. "Thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen." Through the amen, Cynthia continued on.
"For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen."
She looked up with the little twinkle Johnny had come to like quite a lot.
"That's the way I learned it. Kind of a Protestant dance mix, you know?"